Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Islamic History Podcast. Today we will be continuing our series called The Special Relationship. This series, we're discussing the relationship between the United States and Israel. And in this particular episode, we will continue to discuss the history of this relationship, which we began in the previous episode. We will also discuss the given reasons for the continuous U.S. support for Israel. And finally, we'll look at some reasons why Israel may not really be that great of an ally for the United States. Before getting started, I want to ask you, if you can, if you would like to join the Islamic History Podcast group on Telegram. It is currently an open group, so no invitation is required. You can just search for it on the Telegram app, though eventually, once we get enough people, I plan to change that, inshallah. The group is very simple. I typically upload transcripts and notes of these various episodes in case you want to read through my research. I have lots of old video clips and random things related to Islam and Islamic history, which you can join. And of course, because Telegram is an app and the app is on my phone and the phone is usually on my person, in my pocket, in my hand, or on my desk, if you message me through Telegram, through the group, you are much more likely to get a more immediate response, inshallah. So if you have the Telegram app and if you would like to be able to connect with me or see some of the many random things I've done over the years regarding Islamic history, by all means, go ahead and join. Once again, it's called the Islamic History Podcast group on Telegram. All right, so let's continue our discussion of the history of this special relationship between the United States and Israel. When we left off, we were discussing, I believe, the events of the 1970s. I want to talk about the Ramadan War of 1973. Sometimes it's also called the Yom Kippur War or the October War. But this was a war that started on October 6, 1973, when Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack on Israel. Now, when the U.S. learned about the attack, the United States actually expected Israel to quickly win, even though they had been caught off guard. But to everyone's surprise, Egypt and Syria made significant advances into Israel. So because they were afraid that these two Arab nations might overrun Israel, President Richard Nixon, who was president at the time, ordered a $2.2 billion emergency military transfer, military equipment transfer, airlifted to Israel, which ultimately allowed Israel to turn back the Arab advances. Besides just the emergency military transfer to Israel, the United States also used its diplomatic strength to turn the war and the post-war negotiations into Israel's favor. For instance, the United States convinced Jordan to stay out of the conflict. At first, when the two Arab states looked as if they were winning, the United States convinced Jordan to stay out of the conflict. And then Secretary of State at the time, Henry Kissinger, convinced the Soviet Union to agree to a ceasefire that the United States was brokering that gave Israel a dominant position. The United States also turned a blind eye and ignored Israel when Israel violated that ceasefire. Now, this angered the Soviet Union, who were upset that the United States allowed Israel to violate the ceasefire. The Soviet Union threatened to get involved because of Israel's violation of the ceasefire, and the United States immediately put its entire military on alert. The entire U.S. military on the entire planet was put on an alert, and the United States issued threats, subtle and not so subtle threats, that they were willing to go to war if the Soviets got involved for getting upset because Israel violated the ceasefire that the United States helped to negotiate. Again, all of this fighting between the Arabs and the Israelis was all about the Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. The United States, however, continued to push Israel's interests above the Palestinians, and it promised not to work with the Palestinians until they accepted United Nations Resolution 242. Nothing was said about the many UN resolutions that Israel has not accepted or violated, but UN Resolution 242 basically acknowledges Israel's right to exist, and so the United States was saying, we're not going to work with the Palestinians until they accept this resolution from the UN. So, and once again, needless to say, but I'll mention it anyway, the United States has done very little to pressure Israel to accept the numerous UN resolutions that are in favor of the Palestinians. In addition to pressuring the Palestinians to accept UN Resolution 242, the United States went on to increase its military aid after the Ramadan War and also agreed to allow Israel to participate in any discussions between the United States and the Palestinians. What this means is that the United States cannot do anything with Palestine without Israel's involvement and approval. All of that came out of the repercussions of the Ramadan War of 1973. Let's move on to the 80s. In 1982, June 1982, in fact, Israel invaded Lebanon. The Israeli defense minister was Ariel Sharon at the time. He decided to launch an invasion into southern Lebanon. The reason why, and we discussed this in season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast, but just to summarize it all for you, there are several PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, militants who have set up a base in Lebanon, and they were using this as a base to fight Israel. Israel's plan was to invade southern Lebanon, defeat and remove the PLO militants and the Syrians who were backing them. After they did that, their plan was then to install a Christian Lebanese politician named Bashir Gemayel, who would more or less be more favorable towards Israel. But things didn't quite go as planned. Israel's Lebanese puppet, or supposed puppet, Bashir Gemayel, was assassinated, and fighting between the Muslims and Christians of Lebanon escalated. As we all know, Israel turned a blind eye, perhaps even encouraged, the Christian Lebanese terrorists to massacre the villages of Sabra and Shatila. Fighting in Lebanon continued to escalate, and eventually the United States was drawn into the conflict, leading to two terrible tragedies. 63 people were killed by a suicide bomber at the U.S. Embassy in April 1983. And then the big one, 241 U.S. Marines who were stationed in Lebanon were killed by a truck bomb in October 1983. Here is the United States suffering hundreds of deaths for getting involved in a conflict that was escalated and perpetuated by Israel. The U.S. government was, of course, upset with Israel for the Sabra and Shatila massacres and for invading a sovereign nation, but despite their anger, it did nothing to punish nor reprimand Israel. In fact, that same year, in 1982, Congress approved an additional $250 million in military aid for Israel, and in the following year, in November 1983, the United States established what was known as a Memorandum of Understanding with Israel. This is basically a formal declaration recognizing the United States and Israel's close relationship and further encouraging strategic military and security cooperation between them. Now, as a result of this action by Israel in the early 80s, this directly led to the formation of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was founded as a reaction to Israel's invasion of Lebanon. So that's the 80s. There's more to it, but we're just briefly going through certain incidents, highlighting the lopsided support that the United States has given to Israel over the decades. In the 1990s, there was a major push, particularly by President Bill Clinton, to bring a long-term peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Essentially started in the early 1990s. This is more or less a reaction to the war in Iraq finally coming to a close, but also other problems in Muslim-related nations in the early 90s, particularly the U.S. involvement in Somalia, and also, of course, the war in Bosnia that we've discussed. So the United States wanted to try to bring a long-term peace, and this ultimately led to the Oslo Peace Accords in 1993. Again, much more details given in season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast. Oslo Peace Accords went along. They tried again in the late 1990s, but that kind of fell apart. And the thing is that even though it fell apart, I'm not going to talk about why it fell apart, because that is discussed in season 6. I won't get into those details. The thing is that the United States was supposed to be a neutral mediator throughout this process. But when we look at the details, we see that the United States almost always sided with Israel during the negotiations. When the Israelis and the Palestinians disagreed on some topic, the United States almost always pressured the Palestinians to accept the Israeli demands. Instead of trying to find some sort of suitable middle ground, which is what a neutral mediator is supposed to do, the United States would pressure the Palestinians to accept what Israel wanted. The United States also made sure that they would never propose anything to the Palestinians without first running it by the Israelis. So this showed the United States not necessarily being a neutral mediator, instead working as the special counsel or the attorney for Israel in these negotiations. So there's much more to it. We can go through the 2000s and even up until now, but I'm going to really stop with the history at this point because there's just so much. So I really want to get into the question of why does the United States continue to support Israel? Why has it been doing this for so many decades, starting from at least the 1960s, late 1960s? We have the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and that's over 60 years that the United States has been supporting Israel. Why? Now, for certain U.S. allies, it makes strategic sense for the United States to protect them. We're not talking about whether we like it as Muslims or not. We're not talking about the Islamic righteousness of it all or anything like that. We're just talking about pure, cold, hard, strategic interests for the United States. That's it. Whether these protections that the United States provides to certain nations, is it in the United States' favor? Now, as we all know, the United States is a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It is understandable, whether you like NATO or not, that's not the question here. It makes complete sense for the United States to commit to protecting its allies within NATO. That's an agreement. The United States has a treaty with these nations that if they are attacked, they will protect the United States will protect them. And if the United States is attacked, these nations will protect it. This is an agreement that they have, like it or not. This is the way things are. So from a strategic point of view, the United States kind of has to protect its allies within NATO. Another thing that we may not like as Muslims, but it is still from, again, cold, hard politics and plain old strategy, the United States has a vested interest in protecting and preserving the oil-rich nations of the Middle East. And yes, I know that leads to lots of corruption, leads to war sometimes, but the United States has to protect that oil because that's his money. Quite frankly, I'm not going to get into all the details of it, but throughout much of history, it may be changing soon, but throughout much of history, all oil in the world is bought and sold in U.S. dollars, which makes the United States the reserve currency of the globe, and the United States has an interest in protecting this status. Like it or not, it makes sense from a pure political, military, economic, financial United States perspective. It makes sense. However, there is very little strategic benefit to supporting Israel. Israel is not an oil-rich nation. Israel is not part of NATO. Israel cannot really help the United States in terms of military. Why does the United States spend so much effort in supporting Israel? Now, there have been many excuses given over the decades, really. There was initially the Cold War excuse. With Israel in the Middle East, the United States could easily restrain, or at least more easily restrain and restrict Soviet influence in the Middle East. The United States, its whole plan during the 1970s and the 1980s, but especially the 1970s, its whole plan was to convince the Arab states of the Middle East that depending on the Soviet Union was a pointless endeavor. They believed that if the Arabs were continuously beaten by the Israelis, with the Arabs being supported by the Soviets and the Israelis being supported by the Americans, if the Arabs were continuously beaten by the Israelis, the Arabs would come to the conclusion, well, siding with the Soviets is not doing us any good. Let's go ahead and join the American camp. And this did work to a certain extent with Egypt. Anwar Sadat eventually sided with the United States and signed a peace deal with Israel. So up until 1991, The primary excuse for supporting Israel was to defeat the Soviet Union in the Cold War. However, once the Soviet Union fell, that excuse really no longer held true. Furthermore, one of the major reasons that so many Arab states aligned with the Soviet Union was because of America's close ties with Israel in the first place. It wasn't like the Arab states just loved the Soviet Union. They had no choice because the United States kept backing Israel. Even if war broke out between the United States and the Soviet Union, Israel could not really do any significant harm against the Soviet Union. Even now, Israel is no match for Russia. Even the Soviet Union no longer exists, but Israel is no match militarily for Russia. Israel could not provide any significant assistance to the United States if war broke out between the U.S. and the USSR. So the Cold War excuse, if it ever really made any sense, and to me it doesn't really make any sense, it definitely does not make sense after the Cold War is over and the Soviet Union fell in 1991. Another excuse, especially after 2001, was terrorism. Both the United States and Israel have been victims of terrorism in the past. Now, if we're honest, however, many nations have been victims of terrorism, including many Muslim nations. So just simply using the fact that they have a shared history of being victims of terrorism is a bit much. It's also important that we remember that many of the so-called terrorist activity is actually a response to Zionist colonization of Palestine. If they were not colonizing Palestine, if they weren't treating the Palestinians so terribly, then there will most likely not be nearly as much terrorist activity. By the way, Israel has killed many more Palestinians than Palestinians have killed Israelis. So as far as terrorism is concerned, I think the Palestinians have experienced a lot, much more from the hands of the Israelis. It's just that their terrorists wear uniforms. That's all. And some of them don't. Some of the settlers do not wear uniforms. The point is that the so-called terrorism is a reaction to the terrorism that is being inflicted upon the Palestinians. Now, of course, after September 11th, there had many of the pundits who were really just against Muslims. They tried to create the argument that the United States and Israel were fighting against a common enemy. They said terrorists, but they really meant Muslims. And not just any Muslims, but Muslims who were willing to fight against oppression. And they're willing to fight against oppression, they were labeled as terrorists. So after 9/11, many of these pundits tried to say that the United States was attacked because Muslims hated their freedom. I was surprised to see that there's still some people saying this today. I was recently watching a debate between Megyn Kelly and Glenn Greenwald. I'm not going to explain who these two are, but you can just look it up. And in this debate, they're talking about essentially the current massacre going on in Gaza right now. And Megyn Kelly tried to make the argument that Iran, the government of Iran, did not hate the United States because of Palestine. It hated the United States because of its freedoms. That is such a stupid argument. I can't believe that people are still perpetuating that. I can kind of understand it, though I really don't. I can kind of understand people running their propaganda back in the early 2000s when they had to try to rally Americans behind its ridiculous and illegal and unwarranted invasions of Iraq. But now, 20 plus years later, they still are trying to run that out. It is ridiculous that this argument is still being considered. Nonetheless, in the early 2000s, after September 11th, this was a thing that people were saying. The reality is that one of the main reasons the United States was attacked in 9/11 was due to its support of Israel. Bin Laden said that. He said that not only back then, but as we now know, this was brought up in the interview between Megyn Kelly and Glenn Greenwald. When Bin Laden's manifesto got out on TikTok before they banned it, Bin Laden clearly laid out his gripes, the reason behind his hatred for the United States. It had nothing to do with the Constitution or this freedom of speech or the fact that women can dress any way they want to. It had nothing to do with that. It was about the United States getting involved in its Middle Eastern affairs, in Muslim nations, in its war in Iraq, but also for its support of Israel in its oppression and persecution of the Palestinians. Let me read you this quote from the Israel lobby. Listen to this. Instead, Palestinian terrorism has always been directed solely at their perceived grievances against Israel, beginning with resistance to the original Zionist influx and continuing after the expulsion of much of the Palestinian population in the 1948 war. Today, these actions are largely a response to Israel's prolonged campaign to colonize the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and a reflection of the Palestinians' own weakness. These territories contained few Jews when Israel captured them in 1967, but Israel spent the next 40 years colonizing them with settlements, road networks, and military bases while brutally suppressing Palestinian attempts to resist these encroachments. Not surprisingly, Palestinian resistance has frequently employed terrorism, which is usually how subject populations strike back at powerful occupiers. I would say this all debunks the terrorism excuse. So now there's another excuse, the strategic excuse. Using this excuse, and we've heard this concept before of Israel being like a battleship for the United States in the Middle East. The reasoning behind the strategic excuse that the United States supports Israel because there is a strategic benefit, the reasoning behind this is that Israel gives the United States a friendly nation in the Middle East. This is kind of ridiculous, however, because Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, and many other nations in the Middle East are all U.S. allies. Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, Oman, Bahrain, these are all countries that have at least, that are at least on friendly terms, if not true allies of the United States. Furthermore, the United States has several bases spread throughout the Middle East, and most of them are not in Israel. So the United States does not need Israel to have a friendly nation in the Middle East. It has a bunch of friendly nations in the Middle East. Also, let's understand that Israel cannot help the United States protect its oil interests in the Middle East. As we mentioned before, and we have to acknowledge that one of the major reasons behind the United States' continued involvement in the Middle East, besides Israel, is oil. However, Israel couldn't really help the United States protect its oil interests in the Middle East. First of all, none of these majority Muslim nations in the Middle East, none of them could allow Israeli soldiers on their territory without risking a coup, without being overthrown. They could never openly allow Israeli soldiers on their territory or in their territory. And again, most Middle Eastern nations are already allies with the United States. So this shows that there's really no military strategic benefit for this continued support for Israel. Now, it is true that Israel has helped the United States with espionage and intelligence. But while that is true, the United States doesn't really need Israel's intelligence. That's first of all, let's acknowledge the United States' its intelligence capabilities are far beyond whatever Israel has. Again, the United States already works with most Middle Eastern intelligence agencies. The CIA and the FBI already have connections with most Middle Eastern nations, their intelligence services. They already have a working relationship with most of them. The United States already has inroads to all of this stuff. Another thing to consider is that very often Israel has given the United States incorrect intelligence analysis in the past. Before the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel was constantly giving the United States exaggerated reports of Egypt's military. But U.S. intelligence analysts, they kept rejecting the Israeli analysis because they believed that it was an attempt, and it was true. They believed that it was an attempt by Israel to push the United States to provide them with more weapons. Also, more recently, in our own memory, Israel also provided exaggerated intelligence about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction in the early 2000s. Now, let's be fair, the United States was already determined to go to war against Iraq at that period of time. But the United States still used this exaggerated intelligence from Israel to corroborate its own bad intelligence to justify going to war against Iraq in 2003. Whatever strategic benefits Israel gives to the United States in the Middle East, they seem kind of minor, if any at all. The one excuse that is continuously trotted out, however, is the moral excuse. The reasoning behind the moral excuse is that the United States and Israel share a common bond, whatever that means. I have no idea what that means, but there's this moral idea that the U.S. and Israel share a common bond. It is often boiled down to the idea that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I'm not sure why that's important, because the United States has worked with many other non-democratic nations. And if we're honest, Israel's democracy is pretty shallow because millions of people who live there cannot participate in that so-called functioning democracy. Now, we can say, we can admit that Israel does share America's modern liberal values. Yes, we can agree to that. And this is true, but this is really only true for Israelis. Israel does not treat the Palestinians in a modern liberal way whatsoever. The complete opposite, in fact. Israel treats the Palestinians in a way that no group of people on the planet would accept. Nobody would accept the way that the Palestinians are being treated in Israel. Black people in the United States didn't accept it. Black South Africans didn't accept it. The Irish didn't accept it. Nobody accepts the way that these people are being treated. It is not a surprise when the Palestinians choose to fight back. So those are some of the major excuses that are given for the continued U.S. support of Israel. Now, we've debunked all of these, but now I want to talk about the downside of this continuous support for Israel, for the United States, not for the Muslim world, purely speaking from an American perspective, from a U.S. strategic perspective. There are many more downsides to the United States' unconditional support of Israel. The primary downside for the United States has been a loss of trust in the Middle East. Right now, with the current massacre going on, the current attempt at ethnic cleansing in Gaza, everyone can now see and everyone is now aware of the violence that Israel has been inflicting on the Palestinian people, but is now at an even much higher level that it is inflicting on the Palestinian people. Everyone can see this now. And everyone knows, Americans know, Europeans know, Africans know, people in Asia know, people in the Middle East know, Arabs know, Muslims know. Everybody knows that these weapons that are killing Palestinians, they are provided by the United States. And because of this, now the United States is potentially becoming a target for terrorist actions. I don't support this, obviously. I hope it doesn't happen. I happen to live in the United States, so I hope that it doesn't happen. But the United States' continued support for Israel has made it a target for terrorists. And this has been going on for decades. Another downside of supporting Israel is a continuation of violence and strife in the Middle East. The United States' unwillingness to be more even-handed with the whole Palestinian-Israel conflict has led to a never-ending cycle of violence. And the irony is that so many pundits position Israel as being a critical partner of the United States in containing so-called dangerous actors in the Middle East, yet Israel is the main reason that these dangerous actors exist in the first place. As we mentioned, Hezbollah was formed as a direct response to Israel's invasion into southern Lebanon back in the early 1980s. Then there's also the whole WMD situation, weapons of mass destruction. It is common knowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. Even though Israel has neither confirmed nor denied this fact, everyone believes it to be true. But this has, of course, led other nations in the region to want these weapons of mass destruction as well. If Israel has nukes, then Iran wants nukes, and Iraq wants nukes, and Syria wants nukes. And the United States looks very biased and hypocritical when it tries to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, but does nothing about Israel's nuclear weapons. So that's those are some of the downsides of the continued U.S. support for Israel. Now, the final thing I want to discuss today is to point out the fact that not only is there no good strategic purpose for the United States supporting Israel to the extent that it does, not only are there many more downsides to upside to the United States supporting Israel to the extent that it does, Israel has not really been a good ally to the United States. And there's lots of things. I have so much here I want to share with you, but let's go through them. First, we have Operation Susanna. I'm just going to read these different events and just quote to you some of the research that I found online. I didn't go into real depth for any of these things, but I'm just going to give you a summary. Operation Susanna. Now, this is a quote from Wikipedia explaining Operation Susanna. The Levant Affair was a failed Israeli covert operation, codenamed Operation Susanna, conducted in Egypt in the summer of 1954. As part of a false flag operation, a group of Egyptian Jews were recruited by Israeli military intelligence to plant bombs inside Egyptian, American, and British-owned civilian targets, cinemas, libraries, and American educational centers. These bombs were timed to detonate several hours after closing time. The attacks were to be blamed on the Muslim Brotherhood, Egyptian communists, unspecified malcontents, or local nationalists with the aim of creating a climate of sufficient violence and instability to induce the British government to retain its occupying troops in Egypt's Suez Canal zone. Israel has also sold weapons to Iran. This is after Iran became an enemy of the United States. We're not talking about during the era of the Shah, after, during the 1980s. Here's a quote from the Washington Report on Middle Eastern Affairs from November 1986. Over the last 6 years, Washington has several times expressed its disapproval of arms sales to Iran. During the 1979-1981 hostage crisis, Israel was specifically asked to stop deliveries while Iran was holding U.S. hostages, and it is possible that Israel complied. At an October 1st luncheon he hosted, Secretary of State George Shultz assured diplomats from the Arab states of the Gulf that Israel had told U.S. officials it had stopped selling arms to Iran in 1983. That's 1983 that Israel confirmed it stopped selling arms. However, the hostage crisis took place in 1979 to 1981. Israel's military has also embezzled millions of dollars from the United States. Here's a quote from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency from March 1991. A 46-year-old former Israeli Air Force general, Rami Dotan, was sentenced Wednesday to serve 13 years in prison, stripped of rank and dishonorably discharged, under a plea bargain reached with a special Israel Defense Force court-martial at General Headquarters here. Dotan, who held the rank of Brigadier General, headed the Air Force purchasing branch at General Headquarters until his arrest last October. He subsequently pleaded guilty to 12 counts of corruption, bribery, illegal acquisition of $12 million in defense ministry funds, and conspiracy to murder a former civilian employee of the Air Force procurement branch who could serve as a witness against him. Now, that's not crazy. I don't know what is. Not only did he embezzle millions of dollars from the United States, he was also going to kill somebody who could have been a witness. That's crazy. We also have the Lawrence Franklin scandal. Again, this quote comes from Wikipedia. The Lawrence Franklin espionage scandal involved Lawrence Franklin, a former United States Department of Defense employee, passing classified documents regarding United States policy towards Iran to Israel. Franklin pleaded guilty to several espionage-related charges and was sentenced in January 2006 to nearly 13 years of prison, which was later reduced to 10 months house arrest. Franklin passed information to American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Director Stephen Rosen and AIPAC Senior Iran Analyst Keith Weissman, who were fired by AIPAC. They were then indicted for illegally conspiring to gather and disclose classified national security information to Israel. However, prosecutors later dropped all charges against them without any plea bargain. Israel has also sold American weapons technology to China. Here's an excerpt from military.com, the military.com website from December 2013. Secret U.S. missile and electro-optics technology was transferred to China recently by Israel, prompting anger from the U.S. and causing a senior Israeli defense official to resign. The head of defense exports for the Israeli Defense Ministry resigned after a U.S. investigation concluded that technology The head of defense exports for the Israeli Defense Ministry resigned after a U.S. investigation concluded that technology, including a miniature refrigeration system manufactured by Rycor and used for missiles and in electro-optic equipment, was sent to China, according to the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv. And finally, Israel also actively spies against the United States. Now, what follows is an abstract from an article written in December 2020 by Duncan L. Clark. The article is called Israel's Economic Espionage in the United States. Quotes, Israel has conducted an aggressive campaign of economic espionage in the United States since 1948. This campaign has been critical to sustaining and modernizing Israel's nuclear weapons program and an array of its most advanced conventional weapons, even while it has caused American firms to lose valuable proprietary information and unfairly advantage Israeli companies in the international arms market. While other countries conduct economic espionage against the United States, Israel is the only major recipient of U.S. foreign aid to do so. Unquote. So that's going to be it for today. Inshallah, in the next episode, we're going to take a closer look at the so-called moral reasons for supporting Israel, and we're going to see if they truly hold up to scrutiny. But until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Before you go, I want to address something. I recently found a comment about the first episode in this series on the special relationship that we are currently in discussion about. And I'm going to read you the comment, and then I'm going to respond to the comment. This comment can be found on Apple Podcasts. If you go to Islamic History Podcast, then look for the ratings and reviews, you'll see this comment there. I'm going to read the comment, and then I'll respond to it. Bizarre biased assumptions. I follow this channel for a bit as I delve into learning the history of Islam. I saw the new Palestine episode and was cautiously optimistic while skimming the transcript this morning. Twice so far, I've seen mentions of how if Israel stayed a single state and allowed Palestinians to be citizens, it would, quote unquote, destroy the idea of a Jewish state. Clearly, you have never been nor interacted with the hundreds of thousands of Arab Israeli citizens, many of whom self-identify as Palestinians and are descendants of Palestinians. No one is asking you to support Israel, but there's no reason to make up lies. Israel is already the most, I'm not sure what he meant by this one, but Israel is already the most to gain legitimate criticisms. There are many things up for debate, but this is factually not one of them. Very disappointing. All right, so presumably this person, and I presume it's a guy. I don't know why I think it's a guy, but it could be. I don't know the gender. I can't tell by the name. Anyway, the point of that is they're saying that during, when I was going through the potential solutions of for the current Palestine-Israel conflict. I know everybody doesn't like that phrase, but I was going through the solutions. One of them was a one-state solution where Palestinians would be admitted as equal citizens within Israel. And I said that that is not possible because, one, it would destroy the nature of Israel as a Jewish state, and the only way for it to remain a Jewish state would be that the Israeli government will have to essentially continue to practice apartheid or deny certain rights to the Palestinians. Now, and so this writer, this commenter brings up the idea, the fact, it is a fact that there are many Arabs who live within the state of Israel as citizens, and they, on paper at least, have equal rights. However, from what I've read, they are still treated as second-class citizens, at least culturally and socially. But that's not what the question is about. Regardless of that, this is the idea that the one-state solution would destroy or basically end the idea of a Jewish state. Now, I want to let you know that I didn't just make this stuff up off the top of my head. I'm going to read you not one, not two, but three independent sources that verify what I said in that first episode. The first one comes from the American University in Washington, D.C. This is an interview where the interviewer, someone named Kay Summers, is interviewing a professor named Guy Ziv discussing the one state solution. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I invite you to go and look for it yourself. This was actually from November 21st, 2023. So that is after October 7th. And listen to this professor's rebuttal of the idea of a one-state solution. So the interviewer asks, in basic terms, what is a Zionist state and why would a one-state solution in Israel necessarily mean that Israel would no longer be a Zionist state? All right, so that's the question. Here is the professor's answer. Zionism is an ideology that promotes Jewish statehood. It's the liberation movement of the Jewish people. For Zionists, Judaism isn't merely a religion, it's a nationality. The establishment of the State of Israel was the realization of the Zionist dream of a Jewish state that would enable Jews to live freely and safely. Only a relatively small proportion of Jews in the 19th century joined this movement. With the very anti-Semitic pogroms of Tsarist Russia at the turn of the century, followed by the Nazi Holocaust that decimated world Jewry, this minority of Zionists became a majority. Most Jews, including those residing in the United States, the largest diaspora, identify as Zionists. A one-state solution is incompatible with Zionism because Israel would cease to be a Jewish state. It would become, instead, a binational state in which Jews would likely become the minority. This is a quote from Professor Guy Ziv of American University. But once again, I have more receipts for you. So just backing up my statement that it is nearly impossible for Israel to maintain its identity as a Jewish state and implement a one-state solution. But I'm not done yet. Here's another article from Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And this article goes through many reasons why the one-state solution would benefit both parties, but it does take its time to actually go over some of the objections to a one-state solution from both sides, from both the Palestinian side and the Israeli side. Now listen to this particular objection that the article brings up. Quote, "This model also sets off different fears in each camp. Demographic trends suggest that the model would threaten Jewish nationalism, and most Israelis likely would not accept such a call for equality, seeing in it an equivalent to the demise of their current state." Unquote. So that's now two quotes that I've brought from two internationally recognized academic institutions. Now I have one more. This one comes from Vox.com. This article discusses the pros and cons of the two-state solution and the one-state solution. I'm just going to read you the part about the one-state solution because it backs up what I was saying in the first episode of this series. Quote, "The one-state solution would merge Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip into one big country. It comes in two versions. One, favored by some leftists and Palestinians, would create a single democratic country. Arab Muslims would outnumber Jews, thus ending Israel as a Jewish state. The other version, favored by many on the Israeli right, would involve Israel annexing the West Bank and either forcing out Palestinians or denying them the right to vote. Virtually the entire world, including most Israelis, rejects this option as an unacceptable human rights violation." All right, so that's my third quote. I brought you three receipts that backs up my claim of why a one-state solution is almost certainly never going to happen. Not in the way where these three articles are envisioning, at least, where Israel, the government of Israel, admits all existing Palestinians within the current borders of Palestine, admits them as equal citizens, as equal rights, because it would threaten the idea of Israel as a Jewish state. All right, so I didn't mean to add more, an addendum to an already long episode, but I had to defend myself because Mr. Biased Assumptions, who wrote this comment on Apple Podcasts, is basically calling me incompetent. And I have to at least show you that I kind of know what I'm talking about here. This is something that just came up off the top of my head. Inshallah, may Allah guide us. If I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. But if I'm wrong, so are these other major institutions, academic institutions. Well, I'll leave it at that. We'll end the podcast for real this time. Inshallah, in the next episode, we will continue this discussion on the special relationship. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.